evening, everyone. Welcome to, we're going to call this Greatest Generation Live. It's still sort of Greatest Generation with Glenn Flickinger, despite having sort of the subtitle of Masters of the Air. My name's Sean Hall. I'm the Director of Programming with the Veterans Breakfast Club. Excited to have you all a part of our special Thursday night series. And Glenn, you will be host tonight. Glenn, how are you doing this evening?
I'm excellent, Sean. 80 degrees and sunny makes for a nice day in Florida.
That's fantastic. God, I wish I was there with you. We have you here with us, so we could be thankful for that. For those of you who may not know of the Veterans Breakfast Club or maybe joining us for the first time, our mission is to create communities of listening around veterans and their stories to connect, educate, heal, and inspire. We've been doing it for 15 years, mostly the last 3 years online after the pandemic, but we've decided to continue on with our Monday, usually our Monday night happy hour series, but we tack this on during the winter because here in PA, despite where Glenn is, we have snow and cold and no one wants to go out in it. So we had an extra night in for our weeks during the winter. But we have a really spectacular panel of guests today that we'll be getting to very shortly. Glenn, it's great to see you. If you'd love to take it away here.
Okay, Sean, great to see you too. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Glenn Flickinger. I'm on the Veterans Breakfast Club board, a board member for the VBC for the past 4 or 5 years. And I've also been doing this Greatest Generation Live program for about the same time frame. And it's been just a wonderful experience for me because I'm kind of a World War II aficionado. My kids would call me a World War II geek, maybe all kinds of nice names. But it's been a lifelong interest of mine. And so finally, for the last 4 or 5 years, in interviewing authors like these men that are on tonight and lots of veterans, it's been an honor to do it, really. Okay. Tonight, we have five experts on, and I'm just so appreciative of them answering the call here. So at the last minute to be on the air. Let me just go through these four whose books are up here and introduce them, and then Kevin, apologies again for not putting your book up. We'll put your book up a little bit later.
No problem. First,
we have Colin Heaton. Colin, please say hello to the audience.
Hello, everyone.
Okay. Author of Above the Reich, and I'm pretty sure some other books as well. Colin, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, and also your connection with the miniseries coming out tomorrow.
Well, I'm from South Carolina. I had my birthday yesterday, so I'm 62. And my father was Army. My stepfather was Navy. I served in the Army and the Marines. And then after that, I got my degrees. I became a college professor as well at AMU and other places. And started writing books because I had a lot of great stories. Over the decades, I'd collected well over 400 interviews with men who had served in various branches, different countries, different wars. The oldest interview was with Peter Krueller, 99 at the time, in 1984, and he served in the Second Anglo-Boer War. And I got over 100 Luftwaffe aces, became good friends with a lot of them. I knew Adolf Galland very well, he and Heidi, and all the other luminaries. And that kind of brought me into research, and then I began researching who shot down who. And I found out I had a friend named Walter Shook who ended up being shot down by Joe Peterburst. So that goes back a few years, but you know that story.
And that is a great story. We've had Joe on a couple of years ago, and we went through that story, and I didn't realize your connection with it, Colin. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it was a good story. And there's a fellow in Germany who was researching the wreckage of Joe's P-51 while I was trying to compare records on Walter wanting to know who shot him down. And we were totally unknowing of each other. It just came together beautifully in that way.
Wow. That is a great story in and of itself. Thank you, Colin. So next we have Steve Snyder with his book, Shot Down, a book about his father's experience as a B-17 pilot. And we had Steve about 2 years ago and went through the story in some detail. Steve, say hello and tell us about yourself and your book.
Okay. Greetings, everybody. I'm president of the 306 Bomb Group Historical Association, My dad was in the 306 bomb group. I'm also on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society. And as Glenn said, my book that I wrote is Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. And it recounts the individual experiences of each member of my dad's crew after their plane was shot down over the occupied Belgium in February 1944. Various things happened to each guy. Eventually, five of them made it home, but five of them did not. After my dad bailed out, he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture. He was hidden by many Belgian people for a while. Then he finally got tired of hiding and joined the French resistance and started fighting against the Germans. And then finally got back to England after the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day to liberate the area. Been to Belgium six times, doing research on two of those trips. I've continued on to Germany to visit Hans Berger, the Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane. We've become friends, similar to what Colin was talking about. And through Hans, I actually found out that the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans down the same time that he shot them down. They shot each other down.
Wow. Wow.
So I live in Southern California, and they're very involved in the association and society that I'm involved in. And right now, doing a lot of planning for the 8th Air Force Historical Society's reunion in New Orleans this coming September.
Wow. That ought to be quite a reunion. Yeah. Great. And I don't know if you have it to share a little bit later, Steve, but I remember from our program a couple of years ago, there's a great photograph of your father jumping off a resistance Jeep with, I think, a carbine or a gun of some kind in his hand. Here's this man who's been shot down, been in hiding for months, and joins the resistance, and he becomes a French resistance fighter himself for a while. If we can dig up that photo, that would be fascinating to show the audience that have not seen it yet.
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, one thing that's pretty neat about the book is there's over 200 time period photographs, and many are taken by Belgian people during the war in 1944. So they're amazing photographs of my dad with his Belgium helpers and actual, you know, shots, you know, from that 80 years ago. But I can dig that up for you if you want me to show it later.
It's just such a exquisite photo of your father. So
okay.
Next, we would have Rob Ehlers. Targeting the Third Reich is Rob's book. Rob's book is on air intelligence during the 8th Air Force and 15th Air Force air war in Europe. And just had the pleasure to meet Rob a few weeks ago. Rob, tell us about yourself and your book.
Thanks for having me, Glenn. Good evening, everybody. Rob Ehlers, very happy to be with you. I'm an Ohio boy, but find myself at the moment in Colorado Springs teaching a two-week advanced analysis and planning course to our friends in the Department of Defense. I spent about 24 years as an Air Force officer, air intelligence analyst. So some obvious interest in the topic that I eventually wrote a dissertation on at the Ohio State University, and then obviously turned into my first book, published in 2009. Did a couple of teaching tours while I was in the Air Force, one right up the hill here in Colorado Springs, the Air Force Academy History Department, and one for an advanced school called the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies. Three books to date. Targeting the Third Reich, 2009. The Mediterranean Air War, published 2015, both by University Press of Kansas. A book by Brill that I edited called Technology, Violence, and War. It was a fest schrift, a celebratory writing for Dr. Joe Gilmartin, who was my PhD advisor, two-time Silver Star winner, combat search and rescue helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and tragically passed of prostate cancer and its after effects. So we had a conference for him and put that together. I've written some articles and I've been on a couple of the agendas for a couple of other roundtables. I've spoken for Don Patton a couple of times at the Harold Deutsch roundtable and once for Laura Pasuello, who I think many of you know for the Central Pennsylvania Roundtable. I shifted focus heavily to teach these courses because I missed my brothers and sisters in uniform. So wonderful to be with some very esteemed authors tonight and kind of back in this business.
Yeah, thank you very much, Rob. What a background. Next, let me bring up David White, author with his wife, Margaret White, of Wings of War, basically the story of the P-51 and its role in turning the air war around for us, which we're going to be touching on tonight. David, please say hello.
Glenn, thanks for having me on the show, and it's a pleasure to be with all these veterans and with so many great authors. Wings of War was actually my first book about aviation. All my other books and works are about the sea. I started out at the New York Times covering the harbor and the waterfront. Then New York was the biggest port in the country. And now Los Angeles is number one, Long Beach is number two, and New York is number three. My wife and I are going to collaborate. Our next book is going to be on the Liberty ships, the mass-produced cargo ships in World War II. And this story, Wings of War, got started because my wife, Margaret, had a dad, who, by the way, is 104. Her dad was a ground officer in the 20th Fighter Group. And growing up, Margaret heard stories about all the pilots and their exploits. Jack Ilfrey, who rammed an ME-109 in midair and bashed it down without being harmed himself. Many others. And she had done a lot of research, and she finally came to me and said, listen, we got to write a book about this. And I agreed with her completely. And so we wrote Wings of War.
And it's a very good read, audience. If you haven't had a chance, please pick it up. We had some copies at Ed's birthday party last Saturday. It's just an excellent read and a valuable contribution to the understanding of what happened with the P-51, why it took so long for it to come online. So thank you, David. And I hope Margaret's feeling better. I understand she's a little under the weather tonight.
Yep. I came on alone. The show must go on, but she's not, it's not COVID. So it's just a flu or a cold.
A lot of that going around.
Yep.
Okay. And then finally, we have Kevin Maurer. Kevin, please say hello.
There you go. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. You're going to get me on Thursday, but on Thursday, you're going to get lucky. And that's actually the treat. You'll probably just hear me listen to him again. I'm a reporter by trade, so I'm with on this panel with some esteemed historians. I like to say I write beach history. I write it, you know, as fast and as story based as I can get it, and I really was lucky to have met Lucky Luckadoo. I ran across a Q&A with him in the Military Times and was able to coax him into letting me write a book about him. So. For me, you know, a lot of these books that and this panel were books I read as research and to get an understanding of this war. So I'm excited just to sit on this panel as much as anybody and listen to y'all educate me as well. Most of my experience, I've written mostly my books are about Afghanistan. I've just gotten into World War II. This is the second World War II book. I'm working on a third now. But like I said, I was lucky to find... It sounds ridiculous. I was fortunate to find Lucky because I keep saying Lucky twice. And so to me, it was damn lucky reads, much like I think a magazine story, very, very driven on his recollection. Started very much as a biography of him as a way to put humans in the cockpit. And then it kind of migrated out into a look at sort of the cost of the war for him, as well as his friend Sully Sullivan. And that friendship. So I think we'll delve deeper into that Thursday, but happy to answer any questions. But more importantly, guys, for the rest of the panel, congratulations. Like I said, your books were part of my reading list, and I appreciate you guys doing the hard work while I swoop in there and borrow the best parts. So,
well, you do a great job of swooping in. That book is just an excellent read. And everybody should have a chance to read Lucky's story. Everybody should have a chance to listen to Lucky. What a man. 102 years old, just like Ed. You wouldn't think he's a day over 70. His story about how he sort of did the due diligence on you to permit you to write his story, I thought was pretty interesting in and of itself, Kevin.
Yeah, he didn't give it away easily, and he's still sharp. I was down for the 100th Bomb Group had a reunion in Dallas a couple years ago, and I went down early, and I spent a weekend with him and driving around with him. He drove me all over Dallas at like 100 without any trouble whatsoever. I think I was more nervous driving around there myself than sitting with him doing it. So really impressive guy. I think you guys have a treat on Thursday when you get to hear him talk about it.
And he was with the 100th, the Bloody 100th, with the 100th Bomb Group, right?
He was. A lot of what you're going to see starting on Friday, I mean, he knew these guys. These guys are his peers. He was at Thorpe Abbott's for almost the whole thing till early 44. So most of the first part of the series will be with him. He's there. He's not a character, but he'll be, you know, in real life, he was there. Buck Claven, the Butler's character, he gets shot down on the Bremen mission that Lucky flies. That's sort of the centerpiece of the Damn Lucky book. I was sort of disappointed, though. I was talking with Mike Thaley from the 100th Bomb Group about the series, and he, I guess they don't do a really detailed retelling of that mission. I was hoping to get to see what that mission looked like, but for everything I've heard, it's amazing. And Lucky was at the premiere in LA with Spielberg and everything, and got to see it, and he gave it the stamp of approval.
Yeah.
I've had the pleasure of meeting Lucky on several occasions, and he's an amazing man. Basically, he's a rock star, is what it is.
Yeah. We did that book over COVID every day for an hour and a half for months. So he's really my COVID guy that got me through COVID. Couldn't have a better co-pilot right through COVID than Lucky do.
I'm sure that was a great treat to work with him for that time frame.
Yeah, he's an impressive man.
Yeah. So let's. It's a great segue, perhaps, into the first question. I'm just going to throw out to our panel, and it's before we kind of get into the history part of this, which we'll get to. But what's the panel's expectations of? The miniseries starting tonight of the Masters of the Air. There's actually two episodes. The first two episodes air tomorrow night. I'm only guessing at what these episodes are going to cover, as I guess most of us are. But what are your expectations, and what do you think we ought to tell our viewers to look for as this unfolds? Let me pick somebody. Steve, your thoughts.
Okay. Well, I think it's going to be very good. You know, Hanks and Spielberg are involved in this, and the Band of Brothers and the Pacific were fantastic. So my expectations are pretty high. I guess a few things I'm looking for is, you know, how much they're going to dramatize, you know, and Hollywoodize the story and kind of drift away from the actual events. But the other thing is probably, you know, CGI, you know, what those bombing missions are going to look like. How realistic, again, I think I think they're going to do a good job. Also, if they stray from kind of actual history, I've heard and I believe the Tuskegee Airmen are going to be in the series.
Yeah.
And they never flew in the 8th Air Force. They flew with the 15th Air Force out of Italy. So that's, you know.
Kind How did they get there, right? How did they know, jump?
Grinds me a little bit, but, you know, they're trying to appeal to a wide audience. And then the last thing is just, you know, how they're going to kind of portray the 8th Air Force and the air war over Europe. I know the it's centered around the 100th Bomb Group, but there were 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force.
Yeah.
And I just want to see how they kind of emphasize that, you know, because, you know, some of those had more missions, lost more men, had served longer, had more distinction than the 100th. So we'll just see how that plays out.
It's a little bit like, and I talked to a couple of veterans about this 20 years ago after Band of Brothers come out, where they focus on Easy Company of the 101st Airborne. Well, there were, whatever there was, 70 or 80 Easy Companies in the war in Europe. And some people that were there took that as a little bit of an affront. Most of them took it as, hey, this is representative of what all the Easy Companies went through. And we're very happy it was told. So we'll see. Colin, what are your thoughts about the Masters of the Air series coming up?
Well, I worked on it.
Yes. I forgot to mention that, Colin. Sorry. Tell us what you did on it.
Well, I was asked to be the Luftwaffe researcher because I had thousands of photographs, hundreds of interviews with the German pilots, after action reports in their own German typewritten hands, and the Abschüsse, and then I have the Mighty 8th War Diary, so I could compare missions and losses to dates, and then the German records. And then I got an email from, Dale Dye's involved, and I'm working with him on something else. They're releasing another one of my books. But I got a phone call from Marilyn Walton, who worked on the series. She was president, or still is president, of the Stalaglyph III Prisoners Association. Her father was shot down and was in the Stalaglyph III. And so I received a phone call, and then she said, you're going to get an email from Jess Bradbury in London. And I'm like, I don't know this person. So I got the email, and it was Jess Bradbury asking, she was vetting me basically to say, well, what can you do for us? We need information on German fighters. And I'm like, well, I've only written, I don't know, 14 books. So what can I do for you? And so she said, well, we have three guys that we hired, and Oxford, Cambridge types, whatever. And well, I want to send you what they sent us and see if you can provide any more information. And 3 months of research came to me, and I gave her more in 5 minutes than she had in 3 months. And she says, you're hired. So what I want to see is the CGI work, the accuracy of the B-17s. I mean, there was some criticism on my Facebook and some other social media about not seeing the B-17Gs in action. And I tell people they weren't available in 1943. So you have to be aware of the type of aircraft and the period of history you're talking about. Also, the fact that I saw the clips and I saw the teasers, trailers, and all of this, and I was pretty impressed with most of what I saw. A couple of things kind of made me think, but I'm not too concerned about the Tuskegee contribution because I knew Ben Davis and I'm an honorary Tuskegee Airman. And they did overlap and pick up some escort flights on the return legs of some of those missions. If a unit was in trouble and if they were over the Brenner Pass and if they were somewhere in the south and if they could hook up an escort for a way until they were, you know, relieved, then they did that. And in fact, that's how Roscoe Brown got his 262, I believe. That's pretty much it. I just want to see realism. I want to see how they stick to it. And with 9 months of working for Spielberg, Hanks, and Kirk Sadusky and all the questions they had and more information, I can't believe I wasted 9 months and they're not going to use it.
Well, we'll see, I guess, right? Rob, your thoughts on the upcoming Masters of the Air?
Sure. I would echo what my colleagues have said. Historical accuracy is a biggie for historians for obvious reasons. So, you know, how accurately are they, do they depict air operations? And for these early shows, particularly the teething problems and the, you know, the development of the combat box, the, you know, the slow dawning realization that they might have to go to a lead navigator, you know, IP kind of, you know, as all of that developed, through the early missions in France and then the first missions against Germany. Well, that's kind of the first thing. The second thing that I hope they do, and that was done very nicely in the book, is to make clear just how challenging it was for 8th Air Force to get up and running as an effective combat organization with the constant diversions of aircraft, the constant diversions to North Africa, constant diversions through Lend-Lease. All of the friction involved in trying to stand up, you know, a numbered air force in the middle of a major war. Those dynamics were tough for the 8th Air Force. And whatever else anybody says about Aker and Andrews and you know, the senior leaders who were involved with any of that, they pulled their way through that with enormous guts. And so I'll be looking for that. The third, obviously, is just the human interest stories. And you know, the books I write are decidedly short on that. My colleagues, much less so. A lot of really good human interest stuff. And you know, when you read the book, you just get a very clear sense of just the nightmarish conditions that these young men experienced in the air at 30 plus thousand feet and 40 degrees below zero, and how that all rolled. And so I'll be looking for that. So I think those three are my big.
I got to tell you, Rob, I took your book to the pool today, and I'm sitting there reading your book, and I'm making notes in it on my little notepad, sticky notes. And my wife is reading a murder mystery. My daughter is reading a historical novel. The other couple across the way that we know were reading murder mysteries. And they looked at me and said, "What are you reading?" And I said, "Well, this gets a little more detailed than your murder mysteries, but I find it fascinating."
That's when you threw it in the pool, no doubt.
No. David, let's go to you. I know this gets to be more tougher as you get more and more comments here, but David, your thoughts.
I agree with you that Hanks and Spielberg are the absolute summit of their craft, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they've produced about this. I wanted to pick up on something that Rob said. The psychological conditions that the bomber pilots faced were unlike any other warriors. Sailors on ships had days and weeks looking for the enemy, searching for the enemy, and the battles were spaced out. Armies had to march through enemy land and march days to get to their enemy. But the bomber pilots took off every day, day after day, no let out, no excuse. And that's why they finally instituted a limit on the number of missions that bomber crews could fly. The Air Force realized very soon that the psychological toll and the psychological casualties were so great that they were going to have to do something psychologically to heal the psychological wounds of their crew members to keep the planes in the air. And a very important organization called the CME, the Central Medical Establishment, began work on the psychological health of bomber crews, and developed many methods and ways of dealing with the stress that they encountered. They would often use drugs. They had a network of retreats where pilots were sent to sit in the country and hunt and ride bikes and etc. It was the first foray of the military into the psychological aspects of warfare, and the Air Force needed to keep their pilots in the air, and so they led the way on this psychological consideration of warriors.
Yeah, I'm really going to be fascinated to see how these producers portray the psychological factors here. Right, you go back to 12 o'clock High. To me, the epitome of an Air Force movie, the best maybe war movie in my mind ever made. And there it was, made in what, 1948, late 40s, early 50s, portraying exactly that issue. Mm-hmm. I see a hand up, but before we go to our audience hand, let me get to Kevin. And Kevin, I apologize for you being the last in this murderer's row of knowledgeable people, but your thoughts on the miniseries?
No, I mean, no worries. I'll go fast so we can get to the question. I've been looking forward to it since I started working with Lucky. He's been talking about it. I think I'm most interested, I think a lot of what was already talked about, but to me, I've heard so many stories about the guys that are about to be portrayed that I'm interested to see if they match up with what Lucky's version of them and some of the inside stuff that maybe didn't get in the book, and some of it did, but he's got really strong feelings and memories of a lot of these guys. So I'm interested to see what they look like on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame. Don Miller made this point when we interviewed him. unlike Band of Brothers, where Dick Winters, and all those others were still alive and saw it. Here, there's just a few, Lucky Luckadoo, of those that were on the B-17s, but obviously other air war veterans like Joe and Ed, but that are still alive. And it's going to be fascinating to get their point of view after a few of these episodes are out.
He's got an interesting take on the guys too, which is interesting. And some of the stories he would tell and talk about. Because what's interesting with Lucky, and we can get into this on Thursday, is he's got an interesting pathway to the 100th. You know, he's part of that cohort of co-pilots that came in and replaced a lot of the co-pilots that had spent a lot of time with the crews. So he had a pretty bumpy ride, viewed as a jinx, and it took him a little while to get his footing. So I'm interested to see if they tackle any of that or how they deal with sort of the way the 100th gets to England and gets into it. But yeah, no, I think I'm excited, and the little bit I've heard has been very positive.
So we're already 40 or so minutes into this. Let me stop with my questions and ask our audience if they have questions that they would like to pose to our esteemed group of historians, authors, journalists. Anything in the chat that we ought to address, Sean?
Doug mentioned he's interested in the perspective of the ground crews with the many losses they took. Let's see here. No, I think chat's good. So yeah, continue on. Trey raised his hand.
Okay.
Trey, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Trey Berman. I'm 16 years old. I live in Annapolis, Maryland. And again, I'm not super knowledgeable in airplanes. I mainly do boats. Coincidentally enough, I actually volunteer aboard a Liberty ship. So it was pretty neat to hear that Mr. David White is doing the book on Liberty ships. So it's always nice to have that there. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. It's a very overlooked part of World War II history, in my opinion. Because they're just super neat. But Glenn and Sean and anyone else who's probably been on 8th Air Force kind of Zooms that we've done before probably knows what question is coming next. It's what I ask every single time. And usually, you know, people will give me an answer kind of comparing the two. But this one, I really want to challenge everyone. I want a yes or no, or I want one or the other as the answer. And here it comes. What do you think is the better plane, the B-17 or the B-24?
B-17.
Wow.
B-17.
You wanted to hear what the German pilots thought about both?
Fascinating. Yes.
Yeah.
They'd rather go up against a B-24 than a B-17, because if you hit the high wing on the B-24, you can separate it from the fuselage and hit the fuel tanks, so it was easier to shoot down.
There you go.
David or Kevin, any thought?
I'll go with what Lucky said. He said the B-24 was the box the B-17 came in. So I'll go with B-17.
David,
if I may add one thing very briefly for this young gentleman, the B-17 also had the highest crew survival rate in the case of a shootdown of any heavy bomber, and in fact any medium bomber produced in the Second World War. So the crews had to do some enormously dangerous stuff, but they knew their airplane was tough.
Mm-hmm. I'll say two things. You know, I've talked to pilots who flew both. And any pilot that flew both always preferred the B-17. You know, I go to these 8th Air Force Society reunions, and the veterans are dwindling. But, you know, a few years earlier, there used to be a lot of heated discussions between the B-24 guys and the B-17 guys. And one comment that a B-24 guy said that really stuck with me, kind of funny, he goes, well, you know, a B-17 actually had an 11-man crew. They had 10 crewmen and a publicist.
I'll give you a quick answer, Trey, from Don Miller. who maybe Trey, it was you who asked him this a month or more ago. I don't think it's in his book, but who was the first enlisted man to win a Medal of Honor? Snuffy somebody?
Snuffy Smith and the 306 Bomb Group.
Snuffy Smith. And so Don Miller told a little bit of the story of the of Snuffy Smith and what he did to earn the Medal of Honor. And he goes, you know how we knew he did those things? He said, everybody saw him from around the other planes because his plane had been so shot up that you could see right through it in most of the plane. And yet it still made it back to England with Snuffy and the crew on board. Right. And he mentioned just the steel shell that it was made out of was so tough versus the skin itself was nothing. Couldn't stop much in the way of any kind of bullets. Right. So I thought that was, I never heard that story before. And I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah. Also, if you had to ditch the, because of the, where the wings sat on the plane, you know, up high on the 424 down lower on the 17, the B-17 would float for a while and the crew could get out. The B-24, those crew members had no chance of getting out if they came, if they had to ditch in the channel or the Reds, the North Sea.
Well, and I had another guy tell me one time because he, you know, many of those B-24s were made up the Willow Run factory by Ford. And he said, it was just a damn Ford. So, okay. Any other comments there? If we don't have any other questions, I'm going to pose sort of a big macro question to our panel. Strategic bombing. And this kind of gets to the end of the war and the strategic bombing survey that was done. Did it work? Was it successful with all the cost in human lives, resources, et cetera, was it worth the cost? Because there's been, after the war, when that survey came out, there was a lot of question as to whether it had made an effective contribution to winning the war in Europe.
I'm going to ask. I think the most important thing is that the other services were useless. There were no armies on the land in Europe. There was no land war. There was no naval war. I mean, you couldn't line up a fleet of ships and try to bombard the German citadel from the sea, and the land armies were useless, and the only fist that we had to attack attack the enemy with was the air war and the bombers. So bombers were our only way to strike a Germany really from 1942 until 1944 when D-Day happened and the armies finally stormed ashore, but for most of it, it was the sword and the lone sword. And there are a lot of people who criticize it and question whether it was effective, but in the end it was the only weapon we had to deal with the Nazis for a long period of time in the war.
That's actually almost a Churchill quote from 1940, David. Other than the commandos he developed, he didn't have a way to get to the Germans except the British bombers. So,
yeah, really D-Day never would have happened if it wasn't for the air war over Europe by the air forces.
Right, right. Rob, you make quite a few comments about this in your book. The sort of half of it I've gotten through so far. What are your thoughts on the effectiveness of the strategic bombing and sort of the history of it over the last, 75 years?
Sure. So, clearly the visionaries from Giulio Duhay up to guys like Bomber Harris and Haywood Hansel, who believed at the end of his days that it could and should have been a war winner. Bombing was not a war winner, but it was an enormously important part of the war. It was expensive. Building the airplanes was expensive. The cost in blood was high. People like to say that more airmen died than Marines in the Pacific. So, and that's just in Europe. So I'll just briefly tell you what I think about its role in victory. First of all, it's part of a joint and combined team, air, sea, land team. And it proved enormously effective in that capacity. And it sped Allied victory while reducing casualties. those claims, I think, are almost impossible to refute when you look at what it accomplished. So the major air campaigns, and there were several, most people just talk about the air campaign, but there are really several that really made a huge difference in the speed of Allied victory. Obviously, Operation Argument, you know, starting with Big Week, the destruction of, effectively the destruction of the Luftwaffe as a highly effective fighting force. Obviously, Colin knows a good bit more about the Luftwaffe than anybody else here. But you know, the idea, as Arnold, you know, commanded Spots and Doolittle's, you know, attack the Luftwaffe anywhere you find it, in the air, on the ground, in the factories, because that was the key to opening up the German war economy, the German transportation network, the Deutsche Reichsbahn, which moved every component for the war effort, all the coal for the factories, was the operational maneuver motive force for the Wehrmacht itself. Second, the transportation campaign against Normandy, obviously huge debates amongst Allied senior leadership about what was going to have precedence, transportation or oil. But that transportation campaign by heavies, mediums, and fighter bombers to isolate the battle area, delayed the movement of German units to Normandy, starve them of fuel, starve them of mobility, starve them of ammunition, enormously important in determining the victory in Normandy and the speed and the outcome of the victory. In Normandy, once the Germans ran out of fuel or defeated at the Falaise Gap, the casualty rate was 100,000 to 100,000. Once they ran out of fuel and had to retreat in disorder, it turned into a 2-to-1 casualty ratio. And the casualty ratio went up and up and up in every major ground campaign as the Germans became unable to practice their preferred way of war, Bewegungskrieg, war movement. Transportation campaign against the Reich and its cascading effects that basically really played havoc with the German war industry. The oil campaign that first created local and situational shortages, oil shortages, but eventually general shortages that basically demotorized what was left of the German armored formations. A couple of other very quick things, and then I'll be quiet. Already, the Germans had begun to relocate very large numbers of ME-110s and JUs, the bombers, and others to deal with British night bombing. American daytime bombing forced them to bring most of their single-engine fighters back, where they were eventually chewed up, taking a lot of bombers and a lot of young Americans with them, but eventually chewed up. So, and then a lot of flak forced back as well. And a lot of people have said, well, yeah, but, you know, it was mostly older people, you know, older guys operating flak batteries. Yeah, I got it. That's fine. But they would have found ways to get enough troops with those 10 to 12,000 medium and heavy flak batteries out in the field that would have been effective tank killers and anti-infantry weapons. And finally, the accelerated dispersal of the German war economy caused huge problems. You know, I mean, there are plenty of reports, and I think Colin can tell you a lot more about this, of their airplanes just delaminating in flight later in the war, just terrible quality control problems. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, that's an incredibly good answer, Rob. I think, Colin, correct me if I'm wrong, you would know this better than me. By 44 or so, the Germans had 1 million men manning those flak batteries. And those 1 million men could have been used somewhere else at some point. Is that right, Colin?
That's true. 1.2, I think, 1.2 million. And most of those were teenage school kids. They yanked them out of school because they were so short on manpower, because 72% of the German military stayed on the Eastern Front for the most part. And after D-Day, with the rolling of the British and Allied forces with the Americans, it just drained the manpower. So they had, and women were on the flak batteries too. I interviewed a lady who was, speaking of Bremen, she was a ammunition assistant on a 88. And she was talking about how they used to have to hide behind underneath the concrete bunkers because all the shrapnel coming down from when they would fire their guns to almost directly overhead with the searchlights. And But no, you're absolutely correct on that. Yeah, it was a big drain on manpower. And what Mr. Raylor said, he said absolutely perfect. The strategic bombing campaign was not as effective at hitting German industry as it was in crippling what that industry could move on rails and get to the military. And crippling that rail industry and basically neutralizing any chance of having mobility, that's what won the war. The ground forces would have had a really tough time going forward. And my grandfather was at Metz as a German-speaking intelligence officer. So, and I can tell you right now, that ground campaign, the carpet bombing campaign, and then point-blank directive targets off the Casablanca directive, that's really what helped win the war. A lot of people think it was expensive, it wasn't worth it, and Congress was going to pull the bombers after Schweinfurt-Regensburg on those two August-October missions. But it was a good thing they didn't, because that really helped the Allies.
I just want to say one word about the Dauntless P-51 Mustang here, which really was the critical element in the bombing campaign. Until the P-51 came in, the bombers were being slaughtered by the Luftwaffe. The advantage of the P-51 was its extraordinary long range. Before that came in, the fighter escorts could only fly to the German border, and then they'd be forced to turn back, and the bombers would go in alone, and that's when the Luftwaffe would pounce on them and absolutely destroy them. And they had loss rates of 10%, going up to 25%, with 50% of the aircraft damaged when they returned to base. After the Mustang came in, the fighter wings of the 8th Air Force, which by now were Mustang, shot down twice as many aircraft, enemy aircraft, in March of 1944 as they had shot down in 1942 and 1943 put together. So the effect was dramatic, and this aircraft really saved the bombing campaign at the point where it was at its worst.
Yeah, actually, there were two factors that came in at the same time. The P-50, the introduction of the P-51, and then Jimmy Doolittle taking over the command of the 8th Air Force in January of 1944. And then his directive was to let loose the P-51s to go after the Luftwaffe, as Ben mentioned a little bit earlier, any place on the ground, on land. And by the time D-Day rolled around, the Luftwaffe was just the shell of itself.
Glenn, I don't know if this is right along the line here, but Brad Washbass asked in the chat, he'd like to hear more about the evolution of the targeting process. I heard targeting mentioned a couple times, so I thought this might be a good moment for that.
That would be Rob Ellers, who halfway
Yeah,
through is
so
on exactly that topic.
I'll try to be brief, because I don't want to hog the mic here. The my colleagues have a lot of good stuff to say, but yeah, obviously my first book was about this. One of the great paradoxes or ironies of the developing air intelligence capability and the means for picking centers of gravity in the German war effort is that the British originally determined that they needed to learn how they needed to be able to strike targets during the day. Their original plan was to engage in day bombardment, but they developed a first of all, they developed very, very capable photo reconnaissance versions of the Spitfire, and later the Mosquito, which was called, Freeman's Folly after Air Marshal Wilford Freeman, turned out to be a fantastic aircraft. And they had taken pictures of just about the entire Reich by the middle of 1940. So they knew pretty quickly what to target. They brought everybody with any kind of skill, photogrammetrists, photographers, geographers, anybody who had any experience with these kinds of things. They brought them to the Central Interpretation Unit, later Allied Central Interpretation Unit, when the Yanks showed up. And they began building literally thousands of target folders for different kinds of target sets. And the ones that they knew were going to be really important from either before or very early in the war were fuel. The Germans were terribly short of fuel, highly reliant on the Romanians at Ploiești, and then on their own synthetic oil plants, which turned coal into fuel and were ridiculously inefficient and also obviously really big and couldn't be moved and were pretty easy to hit, even if you weren't, you know, the greatest bombardier in the world. So there was that. The other was that they knew motive power was in short supply. In other words, locomotives. And so they knew that at some point they were going to have to hit those. And finally, as the war drug on and they got more and more intelligence on the Luftwaffe, they realized that that there was an enormous shortage of pilots. So to make a long story short, the British had to shift to night bombing because their losses were tremendous. And when the Americans arrived, they had this beautiful tailor-made air intelligence and targeting system in place that the British had developed already for their own force, that then had to redevelop techniques for trying to do bomb damage assessment and mission effectiveness assessment, munitions effectiveness assessment, and so forth at night, which was really difficult. So it's a really kind of fascinating story about the serendipity of British air intelligence and American daylight bombing.
And any of our other guests like to comment as well? Okay, unless there's anything else from the audience, I could go to another question.
Bruce asked, how effective were the machine gunners on the bombers?
Well, at the beginning of the war, they weren't, I don't think they were ever that effective. But at the beginning of the war, going from practicing in the United States to going over and being in combat on Europe was just two different things. You have the elements, of being shot out at the same time. You had the cloud, you had the elements of the altitude and the temperature and frostbite and anoxia. And so the gunners had so much to deal with. And the closing speed of the bombers and the German fighters, but you only had split seconds to try to fire at any of these. I think that's one reason the reports from the US gunners were so overinflated, because later on in the war, when you had lots of large bomb group formations, and also when you had escorts, I mean, there were, who knows how number of bombers and fighters that were shooting at the same fighter at the same time. So trying to pinpoint who shot down a plane was very difficult.
So one thing I've noticed in the literature of the air war over Europe, Kevin, maybe you can comment on this. I don't want to put you on the spot. Is that I'm going to take a wild guess and say 75-80% of the books, the memoirs, what was written about the officers on the planes, the pilots, co-pilots, navigators, etc. And not too much comes our way about the gunners, who were all enlisted men. I just so happens, it's funny, a month ago I said, I'd love to talk to a tail gunner. Well, in the last month, I've talked to two, or at least I heard one and talked to another. Scott Masters, you're on the program, our great Canadian friend. Wave hello, at least, Scott. There you go. Who interviewed, a man from California, 99 years old, who was a tail gunner about 2 or 3 weeks ago. If you can unmute Scott, Sean.
He's unmuted.
I am unmuted. Yeah, his name is Larry Stevens, and... Larry. I got connected to him through a friend in California, and he set up a Zoom interview. So some of the students got to speak to him, I guess, about 2 weeks ago now.
And what was fascinating was...
Larry.
Pardon?
I know Larry. He lived not too far from me.
One of those California guys.
Yeah.
Well, what's fascinating, somebody asked him, well, why did you become a tail gunner? Who the heck would want to be a tail gunner? And I think the story was, Scott, that he got on his plane for the first mission. One of his buddies, who was going to be the tail gunner, came to him and said, could we switch? I don't really like being a tail gunner. And Larry said, yeah, no problem. And he switched, which unbelievable to me. And then last Saturday at Ed Cottrell's Ed Cottrell's 102nd birthday party, I met Bob Buckler, Pittsburgher, 99 years old, and a tail gunner, who I only got to talk to 5 or 10 minutes. We're going to try to have him on this series a little bit later. Another fascinating man, tail gunner, shot down on his 20, not shot down, shot up on his 24th mission. And the pilot and co-pilot flew to Sweden to land, which was a real no-no, I guess, a real problem back then, landing in a neutral territory. I think you get some of the same stories of guys who flew to Switzerland, but it sounded like it was either crash in the sea or crash in Germany or go to Sweden. So he spent 18 months, I think, in Sweden before he was released. This happened on his 24th mission, which I thought was fascinating. So we're going to have him on. But I don't know, Kevin, have you in your research when you were writing with Lucky, the Lucky story, did you run across any of the waist gunners or the ball turn gunners or their story?
A little bit. We talked a lot about the crew. He talked a lot about, you know, he didn't have much. He got along better with the crew than he did with the officers on board on his ship. But there was a disconnect. You know, I talked to Lucky a lot about how, you know, did he hang out with the gunners, and he really didn't. There was a book too, right when Lucky's book came out, about a gunner, and I can look it up if somebody else wants to talk, and I can put it in the chat. I do remember that there was a book on that, but I was sort of fascinated by the gunners too, because when Dale Dye's crew becomes a lead crew, Lucky gets stuck in the tail gunner position. To watch the back, and he does it once and then, you know, refuses to go back up there because he's just not trained to do it, and he unloads the guns right away, and he's pretty worthless in the back. So that's about the extent of it on that. But I know there is a book out there on gunners, but I what I thought was interesting, and I'll leave it at this, that even I thought there would the barriers between officer and enlisted would come down once you're on the aircraft, and that may be true. And other than I'd love to hear the rest of the panel. I'm sure you guys have other stories, but from Lucky's point of view, that barrier didn't come down, and I'm not sure if that's just because of the crew, because of the circumstance, because of Lucky. There's all kinds of factors here, but I know I was surprised. That was one of the things that surprised me, is that he really didn't have a relationship with much of the crew.
Interesting.
In all of the action reports that I read, I was astonished at how often gunners claimed victories. I had no idea they were nearly that effective. And even as somebody said, they did inflate their figures, but it was still a remarkable participation in the battle. I read the diary of one tail gunner named Kenneth E. Fox. Fox was hit in midair by a shell, and he continued fighting for 2.5 hours with his leg blown open and his side ripped open in excruciating pain. So I guess they were a very important part of the whole thing.
Well, it was, you know, really, it was part of the early doctrine by the so-called bomber mafia that, you know, they didn't need as much fighter support as they ended up needing, as David's book portrays very well, because they had these mass gunners. They had, I don't know, how many 50 caliber guns on a B-17? 11, 12, something like that?
There were 10 gun positions.
10 gun positions, yeah.
And I guess 2 guns a piece. I'm not sure whether it's 10 gun positions or 10 guns, but it probably, I think there were 10 positions with 2 guns in most of them.
Colin, you probably know the answer to that with your detailed knowledge.
Well, the ball turret had twin 50s, the turret gunner had twin 50s, and the B-17G model with the chin turret had twin 50s. The other stations had single 50s, tail, 2 waist, and the navigator also, I mean, the bombardier also had a gun. So we can do the math on that one.
Yeah. But wasn't that the thought, Colin, initially, that Hap Arnold and Akers and the other senior commanders had, that there was enough firepower from a box formation of B-17s that they could fight off any German fighters and didn't need the fighter support so much?
Well, Curtis LeMaid invented the box formation, and I knew he's in my book Above the Rack. He was one of my best interviews, very colorful, I might add. In fact, the lawyers said we have to cut some of this out because we'll get sued. I'm like, okay. But no, even LeMay said that with the geometry that he put into the box formation, it gave greater survivability and greater protection. But he said only a fool would want to go into combat without a fighter escort, at least some part of the way. Yeah. You know, he said Douay and these others who thought that bombers were self-contained, self-defensive units were complete morons. He said, obviously, anybody who thought that ever flew in a bomber in a flak or a gunfight. So,
yeah.
Well, initially, when they, you know, first built the Flying Fortress, or the B-17, which they call the Flying Fortress, they thought they could fly too fast and too high for the Luftwaffe even to bother them.
Yeah.
They didn't think it'd be a problem at all. And then even with, like, some of the people have said, even the box formations were not able to defend themselves from the Luftwaffe without fighter support.
That's true. And one of my old friends who passed away in 86 from cancer, Luftwaffe ace Georg Peter Ader, he had 36 confirmed four-engine heavy bomber victories. And he and Egon Meyer developed the frontal attack together. They JG-2 and JG-26 got their best minds together and said, hey, we're going to, Gallen said, give us a plan. Okay, here's a plan. But the gunners were pretty effective if they were getting flank attacked, because that gave a lot of time to line up your gun. And even though they're flying at 140 maybe or 120 and a fighter's coming in at about, you know, 300 plus, that still gave you a good 15 seconds to line up a target if you saw him coming. But on a head-on attack from an elevated position, say a 12 o'clock high or 1 o'clock high in a rollover dive, you had like 2 seconds to line that target up and hit it as a gunner. And you had the same amount of time as a German fighter pilot to hit that bomber. So that was that. That's what Johannes Steinhoff told me. He said, that's what you Americans call the pucker factor. So, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I tell you right now, I can think of better ways to earn a paycheck than flying in a bomber, let alone trying to attack one with all those guns.
Well, yeah, like Hans Berger told me, you know, if you come in from behind, that tail gunner has all sorts of time just to hone in on you and fire at you. So that was not good at all.
And the ball turret gunner is going to get a look at you too.
Yeah.
And eventually, Colin, didn't the Germans have rockets that they fired from outside the perimeter of what the 50 cals could get to, right?
Well, yeah, by 43, Hans Kanoka told me, and he was flying with JG-11, they would put Verfallicate, that basically it was nothing more than a mortar. It wasn't even a rocket, it was a mortar under each wing of a 109 and some 190s. And they would just lob them into the formation, hoping for the best. But it wasn't until the 262 came out with the R4M rail rockets, 12 per wing, that you could actually get directed fire. If you were good at aiming a gun, you could aim the rockets. And they had about a 600-yard range before they started dropping off. So if you got in close enough, hit it with the rockets, then come back and finish them with the guns. But other than that, no, they didn't really, there really was no fire and forget targeting system back then. It was all see to your pants stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So anything else from the audience here? It's, what do we got? 8:15. We got 15 more minutes with these esteemed gentlemen. Let's tap their knowledge.
Joe asked, what equipment featured on the B-17 was so secret that the bomber crews were instructed to destroy them before abandoning the plane during combat? For example, the Norden bombsight.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because the Russians had a spy in the Norden bombsight factory, Hermann Lang. So the Germans knew all about the Norden bombsight. So even though the bombardier had to take an oath to guard the bombsight with his life, you know, it was of little value.
Yeah, Lucky actually makes fun of that in the book. In some of my first interviews, I was all excited about the chapter where we were talking about the Norden bombsight, and I was excited to hear his opinion of it. And he made the same point, and then was sort of, he thought it was silly. Plus, he didn't think they could hit anything with it anyway, so he couldn't understand why it was so important.
So does that mean the whole concept, and again, part of the initial doctrine of precision daylight bombing, especially adding in the weather factors, besides the fact you've got a lot of Germans very angry at you,
that precision bombing was really not effective, that it was over, maybe an overstatement is the best way to put it.
Well, also the bomb load on the B-17s was not that great. So you had, and the accuracy wasn't that great. And that's why you had to have these formations of hundreds of bombers or 1,000 or 2,000 bombers to drum enough bombs to be effective.
Yeah,
precision was a relative term. obviously, the technologies of the day, even the Norden bombsight, did not allow for the kind of bombing, you know, pickle barrel accuracy that the bomber barons initially thought they were going to get, and not a lot of anticipatory analysis, frankly, you know, as they were prepping to go to Europe to fight the air war. You know, nobody really thought very much about European weather. They should have, but they were very focused on how nicely they were bombing things, you know, in sunny Texas or somewhere in the sunny South, rather than in Europe. Even in the summer with its variable weather. And then obviously they got into the entire sort of nightmare situation of having to develop radar-guided bombing aids, initially OBO and G, and H2S, which became H2X for the Americans, and some of the bombardiers became quite good at using those. The Brits tended to be significantly better, actually. But you know, bombing became really sloppy, frankly, when they tried to bomb through clouds. With radar guided, with these very crude radar guided bombing systems. So precision is a word to be used carefully. Having said that, when you put a force of several thousand heavy bombers over certain target sets in a concentrated way, and you have air superiority verging on air supremacy, and you've got determined young men flying the bombers, they're going to put enough bombs on target. And even if it was only 3 or 4 or 5% on target, that's about what it was on average. That was enough.
Yeah. Well, speaking of precision, don't forget we bombed Switzerland a couple of times too.
Well, there's that. Yes.
Just a small error. Oh. Well, what
Brad
time?
Brad Washabaugh raised his hand.
Yeah, Brad.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to the targeting process. You know, at some point during the bombing campaign, there was a switch to bomb civilians in civilian areas, and the thought was perhaps it would be effective in ending the war. Can we have some discussion on that, please? And how it affected the bomber crews knowing that they were bombing civilians?
I'll speak briefly to it. I suspect my colleagues have some thoughts, too. But, the Americans fought tooth and nail against the idea that they were bombing civilians. It was not morally or mentally pleasant. Now, the reality was that a transportation campaign, which involved, hitting marshaling yards and specifically railroad repair facilities, roundhouses where they hooked up locomotives, shunting houses where they hooked up trains, anything to knock out locomotives. Those marshaling yards, generally speaking, were in the center of major cities. Now, not very many of them were out on the edge of cities. So by definition, bombing, major rail yards at the time in Europe meant that you were putting bombs pretty much in the city center. And they put their aim points on the locomotive sheds generally because they were considered to be the highest value targets. But just like they did with, the cracking towers and the critical infrastructure of the synthetic oil plants, but those were not in big cities. So the Americans who had to bomb, places like Dresden, which actually did have military value, or had to bomb Berlin, a lot of Americans bombing Berlin, had to bomb cities, marshaling yards in cities, they could at least say, look, we understand why this is important. It was hard. American airmen kind of bridled against the idea.
Just let me ask Kevin, any input on that question from Lucky that you're aware of?
Oh, I asked him. One of the missions, they targeted a church in the morning when people were coming out of the church. He didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
His mindset was that the folks they were bombing were the guys that were going to the factories to build the weapons that they had to fight through. And that was the rationale that he took to it. So much of the way, and I don't want to, I'm not going to belabor this point because I really want Lucky to talk about it, but so much of just getting in that cockpit after the first mission or the second mission when he sees the carnage, I don't know if, and I can only speak for Lucky because he's the only one I interviewed in depth. I'm not sure he was that worried about what the end state was. He was worried about getting there safely, getting his crew home safely. The rest of it just sort of got pushed away, which is where I think you see towards the end of the book when he comes home, he's asked to give a speech at church. He declines to do that. And Lucky, the Lucky you see on Thursday is a long time coming. He never talked about it for a very, very long time. And I think that's because he internalized a lot of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, well, if I may, just a brief reattack. I agree absolutely, but and I should have made the distinction. The senior leadership did not like the idea of bombing civilian targets. A lot of the airmen who were being shot at and killed and had friends killed did not have significant problems with bombing Germany.
Yeah, Jimmy Doolittle and LeMay, who I interviewed, knew both. They both stated that they regretted civilian casualties. They did not want civilian casualties. And Jimmy Doolittle told me about this big debate he had with Arthur Harris once about Arthur Harris's methodology. And he said that, and this went in the book, but it was taken out of the book because they didn't want to have any controversy. But and Doolittle was a very polite guy who never swore at all. He was very polite. I mean, the most polite guy you'd ever meet, pretty much. Unlike LeMay. But he said he asked Arthur Harris asked him about, you know, he asked Acre before about getting the 8th Air Force into the night bombing campaign. And Doolittle said, well, we have a tendency to want to, you know, not create additional casualties when they're unnecessary. We want to attack the targets and end this war with precision bombing if possible and minimize the deaths of civilians. And Harris said, I won't repeat exactly my language because, you know, Harris said basically, the buggers asked for it. The buggers shall get it. And I'll bugger anyone who decides they want to say otherwise. So, but Arthur Harris, as far as upper echelon, he had no problem killing as many women and children as he could because he, in his words, according to David Niven, said, they're just going to breed future Nazis. So why not kill them now and, you know, nip it in the bud, so to speak. So.
Well, there's a whole nother set of discussion about the bomber command, the British bombing and night bombing. And
I wrote a book on it.
maybe it's one of them I've read. I've read several. I read a couple of biographies of Harris. And even post-war, there's been quite a bit of controversy with respect to British bomber command and the veterans. And that's for another night because we are at about 8:25, and I'm going to ask one last time, Chad, for anything, or I'm sorry, Sean, for anything from the audience.
Anita, is that your name?
Yes.
Okay, you put a couple things in the chat, but I wanted you can you say your question out loud?
Well, it's more a comment. I'm bringing this back to the Masters of the Air and how it's based on the 100th, but there were many men stationed along the coast of England, my dad being one of them with the 96. And in reading the article from the Smithsonian, some of the, what, four or five major battles that are covered with the 100th, the 96 also was part of. The being shot down, going to Stalag 3 that's supposedly in Masters of the Air, also happened with people from the 96. And the massive march of the POWs. And I'm hoping for the baby boomers of those guys, they can see their dads in those actions, even if they weren't in the 100th.
Yeah. Thank you, Anita.
You okay with that, Mr. Snyder?
Yeah. Yes. No, I totally agree. I think the Masters of the Air is fantastic. I think it's going to bring a lot of attention to what the 8th Air Force did and all the bomb groups did and be a wonderful thing.
Anita, are you the person who was talking to Todd DePastino? Are you the historian for one of the bomb groups?
Yeah, for the 96th Bomb Group Association.
Ah, okay. Thank you for being here tonight. I appreciate it. Todd had mentioned your name to me in an email, but I hadn't had time to respond. So
you forgot me.
The pool water got in my ears and it's really impacted my whole mindset here today.
I'm in Central Texas. Don't pull that on me.
I'm scared of Texans. Well, we hope you'll join us in the future. Listen, we need to wrap up just to respect our 8:30 talk time limit. Obviously, with these five esteemed, knowledgeable gentlemen on tonight, and Anita as well, we could spend twice as much time talking about this.
Look back up here.
And the very last thing I want to do, thank all of you for being here, but specifically the two men who were there, Ed Cottrell and Joe Peterburz, it's an honor to see you on our show. It's an honor to have you as part of this. And we're going to get both of you to come back on one night in the next 8 or 9 nights, probably more towards the end of this series, because your involvement came more towards 44 and 45. And what a role each of you played in shooting down the Luftwaffe, tearing up all those locomotives, et cetera, et cetera. And we're deeply proud of you men for being part of our program tonight. Thank you.
Thank you again, Glenn. And thank you all and have a wonderful evening.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco Free Adagio Health, for your support. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt.